This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 340 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to episode 417 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Alistair H.
And now, on to our read-along. We are continuing this week's An Echo in the Bone read-along with chapter 27, entitled Tunnel Tigers.
So it's Brianna's first day on the job, and she's been locked in some tunnels.
And she works with assholes.
First, Diana does not tell us how she's in there or why, but we learn, of course, as typical with Diana, we learn more as we go. So what had happened was...
It was clearly hazing for me.
It was something like that. But it was also, I can agree it's under the column of hazing. I would say it definitely has a hazing part of it. And it's very possible, we don't get any information, it's very possible that they did this to any new recruit, if you will, even a dude. And it does sound actually something that they might do to a dude. But because of what we know happens later, because of the shock, and because of the time frame, the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, because not the women's movement, but because women in especially certain industries, I guess, were still very new to having, let alone a boss. So there is a check mark or a tally. No, Kiva. There's a tally under the column of hazing, absolutely. But there's like 17 check marks under the column of misogyny.
So no, for sure. And I think that, like, for instance, I'm not in a position of hiring people. I unfortunately, or fortunately, got promoted. So they're letting me make decisions. It's kind of fun. But that being said, I have to interview people. And I do feel like when people come in, I want to haze them just a little bit. But not like that degree of hazing. Like, I just want to haze them to make sure that they got the same vibe. Like, we can all get along. But I would never do anything to this degree. Mine's more of like, take them aside. Make a funny comment. See if they respond. And if they don't, then I move on with my life. But I would never do this. This is stupid.
So what had happened was the door was closed behind her and bolted behind her. Not that we need it. What we don't get is the preceding event. Like, obviously she walked in. She was not, well, we're not told she's pushed in, but it seemed like there's probably some conversation about, oh, let's go look in there or let's go whatever. And she, either because she's the boss or because they let her go, like, I don't know if she took the initiative to walk in first or they kind of stepped back and let her walk in first because, you know, mock respect, like, oh, you're the boss, you should go first. However it happened, it doesn't really matter, but we are not told that she's like forced in there, right? But she goes, the doors are closed, the door is bolted, and she could hear laughter behind these doors. So obviously it's planned, or at least it's entertaining, right? At this point, we know it's entertaining. She's in the hydroelectric tunnel under Lochcarachty. And it actually had been planned pretty well. So what is the evidence we have? Well, Dinah tells us that someone had conveniently asked to borrow her flashlight before they... Oh, see, now I'm reading my notes. Before they thrust her into the tunnel. So maybe she was thrust. I forgot that I typed that. So I would have to go look... I'd have to go back and look at the precise wording. But it's possible she was thrust in there. So, but my point about the flashlight is someone asked to borrow it so that when she was in the tunnel, she would not have it. They didn't return it before she went. And now she had no light source.
Like, there's no way you can pretend this wasn't on purpose. Like, not even a little bit. I at least want to have a little bit of plausible deniability.
I mean, I don't think they care because it's a joke in the end. So they don't need plausible deniability because no one's not denying it. It's a joke. They're doing it to like, we knew you could handle it because you're smart or whatever. Like there's literally no need at this time in history. There's no need for plausible deniability.
No, they'll just downplay it.
Now, when might they? If she, God forbid, got stuck and hurt herself or died in there, then they need plausible deniability. But at this point, they have no reason.
But even then, at the time, for the time period, they'd just be like, oh, it's just a joke. She didn't get it.
Well, and it was a, that's what I'm saying. That's not even a lie. It's truly to them. I mean, did they have other motives? I'm sure. But it was as the whole thing was couched as a joke. I don't think they truly wanted to do. I mean, they may have they may in their own minds have wanted her at work or outside of work to be harmed in some way because of misogyny. But I think on the job, I don't think they need, because it was planned and because mm-hmm. it was so easy to hold out or to categorize as hazing, as a joke, especially given the time period, they don't need maybe the whole thing about plausible deniability, excuse me, not plausible deniability, the whole thing about it being a joke is both their truth and comes plausible deniability. Because they, like I'm saying, they don't need to go further than that. You know what I mean?
Right. I guess my question is, I don't think that we do. We don't know if this is their standard hazing ritual for all new employees, right?
Correct. We have no idea.
So that being said, this may be standard procedure for all new employees hazing. I don't know that, but it just seems really pointed, and especially since we're hearing it from Brianna's point of view, she didn't like it and she shouldn't have to. That's not what they're paying her to do.
So Andy, Craig McCarty, and Rob Cameron were all in on it. These are the three dudes who were there laughing behind that door. And even though she did have a ring of keys, that too had been borrowed to go unlock something. And when the key ring was returned to her, it conveniently was lacking the key she needed.
Naturally.
Now. So it was a huge setup. It was a huge setup. So they'd all been surprised when she'd been introduced as their woman boss. She got the heebie-jeebies from Rob Cameron at the offset.
Those Camerons.
Now she's here stuck in the dark. She walks back to the door and this is the part. So if I were Brie, right? If I were in this situation, yeah, I would freak out. Don't get me wrong. All the stuff she's feeling, I would feel the anger, the shock, the wanting to get revenge, like all of that I would feel. That's normal and human. The thing that would absolute scare the pants off of me is when she, as Diana tells us, she walks back to the door and she hears the truck they'd all arrived
leaving,
in drive away. That's the part that would actually not piss me off. I mean, yeah, you could absolutely get pissed off, but that would actually terrify me. That's the part that would terrify me. Like, they're not there waiting around to see how long it takes. You know what I mean? They're literally leaving you. I mean, no. I mean, they may come back, but you know how it ends up. So, no, the plan was not to go back to the beginning. They may have if she didn't show up at the end. But anyway, so she thinks and remembers, because, of course, I won't quite say Grange, but she and Jamie, well, she's Jamie's child, so I guess it makes sense. Well, no, Claire too. Everybody is a lot of main characters who are in certain situations very conveniently remember things they've maybe only seen once or twice, and maybe even 20 years ago. It's kind of redonk, but whatever. So she thinks and she remembers the diagrams of the plant. She couldn't remember if this particular tunnel had an opening at the other end or not, but she knew it was simple enough to find out. You simply get yourself to the other end. So she discovers through going very slowly, moving very slowly, she discovers there's that little mini train. It's basically an engine with a seat on it. And it didn't move very fast. But the good thing is that this train engine did not need a key. So she's able to travel basically forward and backward. She's able to travel toward the other end. And she goes slowly, because she has no idea how long this tunnel is. And she's like, I don't want to like whip around a corner and fall off the side. It's you have no way of knowing your surroundings or how close you are to like a mountain or a rock wall. So in the dark, as she's slowly going along, it hits her. Not like an idea, but like a thing. And when she kind of comes to or realizes her next thought is she's realized that she's fallen across the console and was hanging halfway out of the train. So she manages to pull herself back in and turn off the engine because it was still moving. That would freak me out as well. And she realizes not just the nasty thing, whatever she felt, that nasty thing, it clicked pretty quickly. She had felt that feeling before, twice before, when she had passed through time twice.
Stay out of the tunnels.
That's pretty freaky. So yeah, so she not only is like in this dangerous situation, she's traveling to try and get out of this dangerous situation, and there happens to be a portal, whatever you want to call it, a time portal apparently, right through the mountain. Nothing marking this out because, again, under the mountain, like, that's a place where humans normally don't.
I mean, that's what happened in when they did season, what, 3? When they were at the on Jamaica and it was under that mountain.
Yeah, but that had a marker on top of it.
Sure did, but there's no saying there wasn't a marker on top of this one. We didn't see the outside. I mean,
Brianna would have, if there were standing stones on top of whatever place this was under, it was under a lock, so there would not have been a marker. Because you can't really mark. I mean, you can put like buoys, but you know, that's there. People aren't searching for places, quote unquote, underwater. Typically, their only reference generally we have to underwater, besides one ish, not it, kind of ish in Voyager, but predominantly is in chapter 19. I think it was the one that was chopped out of the adaptation. Did not include it, and that was where Claire sees what might have been Nessie, right? So she, and that makes right. her think and us wonder, oh, possibility of these portals under the water. And why not? Because under the water is still Earth's surface. You know what I mean? Like, it may be covered by water, but it's still the surface of the Earth, if that makes sense. So, yeah, that freaks her out. And then she thinks, oh my God, what if I jumped? But she realized that her time hadn't changed because there was still a train.
Right, but what if that tunnel wasn't there when she jumped?
And she like literally is stuck in the
in a mountain.
The heebie-jeebies. I don't get claustrophobia, and that makes me want to vomit.
Well, then you haven't been on enough school trips.
Oh, I've been on plenty.
Were you on one where they made you crawl down into an Indian spider cave on your back with about 6 inches of clearance over your face?
I'm sure not.
And then go foot first over an outcropping of rocks to get into a giant pool of area?
I've been on plenty, which means I don't need those because I'm happy the way I feel.
They're terrible. I don't recommend them. I hated it. I had to go down face first.
So as she's like, okay, she calls back in. She realizes her time hasn't changed. She survived the portal, whatever it was, and she's like, okay, let's get back to business. So she slowly continues forward, and then she sees the door. And here's another thing, we don't know if this was part of it. I'm guessing it probably was, because otherwise why even have a padlock? But the door that she sees had a padlock on it, but it was open. So that appears they unlocked it to make sure she would easily, if she could at least get to the other end, she could easily get out.
So what was their plan? If she was too stupid enough to find the other end, she just dies, or they come back and get her tomorrow. Like, what's the end game here,
Diana? I do not know.
Okay,
so its hinges, the door's hinges had been, I almost read removed. No, had been recently oiled, and she easily walked through. And there's a flight of stairs. She goes up the flight of stairs, and what awaited her, of course, was Rob, Cameron, Andy, and Craig. They're like, basically, well done, boss. Let's go get some beers to celebrate.
I want you to know that I would have made them stand up in a line so I could take turns beating their asses, because that's bullshit.
Well, they call her Hen, and she's like, don't. Well, they say, let's go get some beers, Hen. And she's like, don't call me Hen. And then they call her, and they're like, fine. They end up calling her boss. And that's that.
She's like, I'll take boss, I guess. After you locked me in a mountain. Rude. Anywho. And that was chapter 27, moving right along to chapter 28, entitled Hilltops.
So that same evening, Brianna gets home around 7. And once the kids were settled, Roger takes Brianna into his office. He's got stuff to tell her and vice versa. But first, he wants to do her.
I hated this. I hated this because I was listening. I was up most of the night, not being able to sleep. So I just was listening to this book multiple times to make sure that I had heard everything that went down. And every time I heard this chapter, I just got more and more pissed off. He didn't even take 2 seconds to be like, how was your day? He had no consideration for her. It literally had everything to do with him in that one moment. And I was like, you couldn't even give her like 5 seconds. Like, I get it. I get it. You like her. You're interested in her and you like having sex with her. I get all of those things. But what I'm saying is that you couldn't even give her the consideration of being more than just a holster for your wiener for like 5 minutes.
So after they take care of that, he tells her.
You have no comments?
Oh, me? I already said that. Yeah, it's not. That's odd. It's understandable. Like, I'm not saying it's odd to want your wife, but it is a little like it was her first day. A big deal, not just new job, but in general, a new job, first day of new job. But he had to have known. I don't think he could have guessed her day would have been that bad, but he had to have known it's going to have to have been not wonderful as far as that type of industry.
It wasn't
going to
be easy. And it's like, you couldn't even give her the consideration of being more than just that for like a minute.
So after they do that, they take care of him, right? After they take care of him, he tells her about Miss.
I mean, I'm not saying she didn't get pleasure from it, but it almost felt like she didn't matter in the situation to me.
He tells her about Miss Glendenning and the gym incident. And he thinks it best if he goes and takes care, if he goes and takes care of the things at school. And he means to speak with the principal, not the teacher. And of course, Bree is like incandescent. She's like, blah, 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 and that's why he's like, I'll take care of it. You got a job. You take care of it. It's best if I do this.
You're a fiery redhead. I'll take care of it.
And then he asks her about work. And he follows that up with, and why don't you wear knickers?
Exactly.
Or why didn't you wear knickers? And she tells him whatever she brings him up. Well, they catch up about Mandy and the wine bottle. Like why Mandy, how he had, you know, not inadvertently, but he had, and he admits he was irresponsible when he left the bottle there and didn't like watch her with the bottle, and talks about how she threw it through the window.
She's like, what did you think she was going to do?
Again, but how had your workday gone? She didn't give many details. So at this point, we don't.
I'll tell you what, though. This isn't the reason why she didn't, but I wouldn't have wanted to give him details either, because he didn't even consider me to be a human being who wanted to talk about something in my life before he used me as a receptacle.
I think two things. Kind of like when he told her, as he needed to, because it involved their child. It wasn't just a him thing, right? If it's a him thing, he, depending on how serious it is, he has a right to maybe keep some things to himself. If it involves their child, absolutely not. So he didn't have a choice. He really shouldn't have had a choice, and he didn't. He did the proper thing. He did not really have a choice with regard to the gem or the Mandy things. He had to tell her what's going on with the kids, right? And school. Like, that's his job, to fill her in. They need to be on the same team with the kids. She did not owe him a detailed report of her day. Do I think it would have been helpful so that he could commiserate and blah, blah, blah? I mean, potentially, yeah, it's not a bad thing to tell your spouse. I think it's a good thing to tell your spouse. However, just like she reacted to hearing about Jem, I think he would have absolutely and understandably reacted to the way his wife was treated.
I don't know. He's a man of his era. He might have been like, oh, you're overreacting,
honey. The fact that they locked her in a thing.
They're just hazing you. They're just hazing the boss.
Here's the thing. What we do know is she didn't give him details. I mean, she may have said, whatever she said is only what we have in the text. But I know she didn't give him details.
No, absolutely.
And one thing I will say, looking ahead without spoiling anything, this unfortunately becomes a pattern. Now, I'm not saying her hazing part. I'm saying her not telling him how bad things were, I think it's absolutely quote unquote good or helpful, whatever, for the narrative, for Diana's purposes, right? Because it keeps him in the dark about something. Mm-hmm. Even though I don't think she doesn't mean it because she's trying to hide anything. I don't think she wants him to worry or to try and get involved, because then it actually truly will further undermine her at work in their eyes.
It'll make it worse.
In the dude's eyes. So all I'm saying is,
well, it'll make it worse. They'll haze her worse.
Yeah, I just said it would undermine her at work. I don't say power, but her standing, I guess. So however, while I think that is true, and while she didn't owe him necessarily as he did owe her that about kids, her not sharing does not, put it this way, her not sharing this as soon as it happened, well, when she got home, does not set them up for success. Because as we'll find later on, and it may or may not be only in this book. Its effects are in later books. Okay, I'll just say that. But her not bringing him into knowledge about this from the get-go weakens them as a couple in general by not setting them up for success. Now, I'm not going to spoil, so I can't give you details about why it doesn't help them or how it does them a disservice. It is absolutely her right, but by her not doing that, and they don't know the future, obviously, so I'm not blaming them or her. I'm just saying it's unfortunate. I totally understand why, and two things can be true at the same time. So if you read the books, you know exactly what I'm saying. It's just...
Wait, who doesn't have a future?
I didn't say they don't have a future.
You said she doesn't have a future.
I didn't say they don't have a future. I said,
swear I thought that's what you said. That's what I heard.
Telling him does not set them up for success in the future.
Okay.
So at this point, there's a loud cry from upstairs, and they run to see what's up, what's going on. Mandy's had a nightmare. She had a bad dream. And Roger asks her, I think Bree goes back. I don't know if it's just, I put they run up to see. So I think they both go up, but I don't know if Bree's in the room when Roger asks this. It doesn't really matter, but it is Roger that asks. Roger asks Mandy why she'd thrown the wine bottle. And Mandy says because she'd seen the Nucklevy outside the window. So she's having a nightmare about the Nucklevy. And so then she tells him, I saw the guy outside the
window.
Yes. Sorry, I was distracted. Where am I at? So the next morning, Roger checks. So now he's like, oh my gosh, this Nucklevy person, monster, dude, whatever. Now Roger's like, I got to go back and check all the places. So Roger checks the Brock and he's like, nope, nothing there. It looks exactly as it was last time. But the idea, as it should, the idea of someone hanging out around their property, like showing up, like looking in their window, like that freaks him out too, as it should. He decides like, okay, well, I've tried this. He's obviously not in the house. He's not out here at the Brock. Fine. I'll go check out the Dunbonnet's cave just in case, even though that freaked him out too. And no, it was empty as well. And on his way back, he sees the heap of stones Bree had told him about. He gets up closer and he sees indeed, yes, they were human made, maybe around the time of an Iron Age fort. He had those thoughts before. Then he goes over to it just to rule out the fact that the guy might, be hanging out over there. And he can tell by what's around it or the formation of it or whatever that it wasn't Iron Age, but it was ancient as far as humans were concerned. Mm. But there's no Nucklevy to be seen at this point.
Yeah, I don't want to meet a Nucklevy.
Oh, God, no. Those are icky.
Moving right along to chapter 29 entitled Conversations with a Headmaster.
So this episode, we're discussing chapters that are going to be really, maybe not the stuff that happens inside the chapters, but people who are introduced and the characters' reactions to them, and maybe your response to the characters as well, or the new characters. We're meeting people who are going to be around for a bit. Maybe major players, maybe not major players, but I'm just saying this episode really does introduce a number of people who will be, who we'll see again, basically, and not for unimportant reasons. So in this chapter, Roger's keeping his promise. He's going to school to chat with the headmaster, Mr. Mingus. Mr. Mingus was a slender, pale-skinned man with spectacles and what looked like a humorous eye behind them. Quote, he asks Roger what Jem reported to Roger that had happened. So Roger's like, okay, here you go. This is what Jem told me.
He did that wrong. That would not have been what I'd have said. I'd have said, I want to hear what you think happened.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, it's not the best analogy, but it's kind of like, as I understand, if you're a realtor and you're walking people through a house, you go first. You lead that conversation. You lead that tour. Maybe for different reasons, but you are in this case, not the child expert, but it's your turf, basically. This is your job, your role. And so here, I don't disagree with you. It's lucky that Jem did read it as you know, read it, report as truthfully as he did, because that's just Jem. Mm-hmm. But yeah, absolutely. If you're the parent, I want to hear from the teacher.
Oh my God,
first.
That would not have flown.
No,
not even a little bit. I'd have been like, no, I want to hear what you have to say happened, because right. I want to hear what you have to say before I tell you what my kid had to say.
Yeah.
Because if yours is so vastly different from what my kid had to say, then there is obviously nothing I say here is going to even matter.
Exactly. So he asked Roger what Jem said. And so he relates it. So what had Jem actually said to the teacher? Like, what was what were these bad words or this Gaelic cursing he had done? We still don't get that. She doesn't tell us. Mm-hmm, but some of the kids had understood what he'd said, and they'd already told others. And because Mingus also understood the Gaelic. So because Roger explains he's not there to complain about Jem getting spanked. I'm sure he doesn't love it, but he's not there to complain about how the issue was handled with regard to punishment. He's there because of the fact that the teacher called him out and assaulted him because he spoke Gaelic.
I'm like,
and he's like, Jem should not be harassed for speaking Gaelic. And then Diana gives the reader a history and linguistic lesson about the recent decline in Gaelic. Not recent as per now, recent as per the late 70s, early 80s. So we learn more and about why it was such a big deal to why it is or was such a big deal to some people, including that teacher. And Mr. Mingus says he's had a word with the teacher and he can assure him it will not happen again. And Roger says, okay, if it does, I will not be coming back with a shotgun, but I will be coming back with the sheriff and a newspaper photographer.
Better than that. I'll be coming back with my wife.
Oh, no. To document Miss Glendenning being taken off in handcuffs, unquote. And as they leave, Mr. Mingus tells Roger that Jem's reputation certainly didn't suffer, even if his ear did. Quote, I think his entire form now regards him as Robin Hood or Billy Jack, unquote.
And that was chapter 29, moving right along to finishing this week's episode with chapter 30 entitled Ships That Pass in the Night. This was a long chapter. And I honestly, I don't understand why they keep getting on boats.
This is why. Yeah,
nothing good comes from boats.
Well, this. Thank you, Alexa.
I mean, is that the only device Diana has at this point? Put them on a boat and have somebody take it over?
Well, I mean, the only device she has to get them overseas.
No, but it's like they couldn't. There is never a boat ride without drama.
And there's never an easy voyage.
She never goes, okay, they got on the boat. And
correct.
Then, like, the next chapter is, the next 3 weeks were uneventful. And they arrived on Scotland's shore doing blah, blah, blah. Like, they cannot cross this passage without drama.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I say, as far as adventure, books 3 and 7, and there may be more that I'm forgetting, but books 3 and 7 are high adventure especially with regard to the ocean going stuff, and 7
is high adventure just code for pirates?
No, 7 with high adventure on the seas as well as battle stuff. So it's got battle and the seas. But whew. So it is May 19th, 1777. So we're back in the 18th century and back with our timeline-ish. So someone's on a boat. We learn it.
Who else?
It's Jamie Clare and others. But anyway, yeah, I will say this. This, yes, it's a long chapter. It was not hard to read because it was boring. It was hard to read because it was long. I kept thinking, oh my gosh, so much is happening. How much am I, like, how much more can happen? And oh my gosh, like, this was it was big and it was so freaking full. So they're standing near the railing. Jamie sees his first hammerhead shark and says, quote, what's amiss with its head? It has some sort of, has a growth of some sort.
A growth.
Which is of course, funny. Jamie looks well, Claire thinks. He'd been eating well and his color was good. And this is, of course, all thanks to the acupuncture needles, right? They talk about what animals they thought were hella strange. Jamie says the mandrill they'd seen at King Louis's zoo, which brings up the topic of King Louis. We learn he died. He died 3 years before, which would have been 1774. And of course, this makes Claire think about her time with Louis in the wake of the loss of Faith, Jamie being imprisoned, the rising, etc. They have a discussion about whether or not people like a king can be held to account for the people under them. And Jamie thinks so. Again, there's much more detail in the chapter. I'm giving the highlights. Suddenly, they learn there's a small gunned ship nearby. It's a British naval cutter. Young Ian counts 16 men, which means it's undermanned, which of course means they might be looking to press some people. Jamie gives Claire his dirk, just in case, Sassenach. They come up aboard, line up aboard, whatever, and some of the cutter's men do, and their captain introduces himself as Captain Worth Stebbings. Now, like, what is it with the word or the name Worth in captain's names? The Teal, the captain of the Teal is named Trustworthy, and now we got a guy named Worth. I mean, it's a wackadoodle, but okay. So Captain Worth orders Captain Roberts, to get all the men.
If you don't have the actual gifts and or built-in skills, then you just change your name so people believe
think that you do. Captain Stebbins orders Roberts to get all his men on deck. Roberts tells him that Jamie and Ian aren't crew, they're paying passengers. And he's like, but they're British subjects, so they're free game. Step off.
He's like, IDGAF.
He immediately takes Ian, and this made me laugh. And at first, after it happened, I was like, the thing that was I'm about to say made me laugh. The reaction to it pissed me off until I realized why he was doing what he was doing. Okay. So Stebbins looks at Jamie and says, quote, a trifle elderly. I don't like the look on his face. Sorry. Mm-mm. Elderly. He's probably in his late 50s, early 60s. I mean, yes, not 20, but wow. So Jamie,
seeing if that had happened and I'd have been there. If I was Claire, I'd have been like, he'll kick your ass. My boyfriend's big and he'll kick your ass.
Jamie, not wanting to be separated from young Ian, insults Captain Stebbins to his face. And so, as he had planned, he's taken also. But so Claire's not upset that he's called elderly. She was like, probably like, thank God. But she's pissed that Jamie purposely got himself taken. She understands probably why, but no, she didn't think Jamie, she hadn't.
I think he just didn't want Ian to be alone.
Sorry, I'm not pausing.
Together we can do this, that, and the other.
I'm not pausing to not talk. Well, yes, I'm pausing not to talk, but I'm not pausing because I'm thinking. I'm pausing because my damn Alexa's going off. No, she didn't think Jamie would allow Ian to be taken, but she also didn't want to be left in the Atlantic Ocean alone. Claire couldn't let this happen. It already happened before when she was...
Again.
Exactly.
That's what I'm saying. Oh. These boat trips are never good.
Quote.
Nothing good has happened on a boat to these people.
Claire's like, Jamie's gone now, right? Because she's taken. She's like, okay, no one's going to help me. There ain't no Mrs. So-and-so with their goats. Like, I can't jump. There's nothing for me to do. I got to take care of this myself. Quote, I seized the rail and more or less rolled over it, skirts flying. I hung by my hands for a terrifying instant, feeling my fingers slide across the wet wood, groping with my toes for the rope ladder the cutter's crew had thrown over the rail. A roll of the ship threw me hard against the side. I lost my grip, plunged several feet, and caught the ladder just above the cutter's deck. Unquote. So she basically vaults herself onto the other ship. Her right hand is rope.
As you do.
His rope burned. But she also had to make sure that she's trying to do this. And it didn't even occur to me until I actually read it. After Diana describes everything she just did, she had to make sure that she actually hadn't been seen. Quote, timing my jump to the next heave of the cutter's deck, I let go and landed like a bag of rocks. A sharp pain shot up the inside of my right knee, but I staggered to my feet, lurching to and fro with the roll of the deck, and lunged forward to the companionway, unquote. Now, what I immediately thought of, but I did not go back and look and see if it was the same leg, was, now, could she have hurt her knee just because she hurt her knee? Absolutely. But as people who have broken and hurt things before, we also know that if you get, they're much more easy to break or hurt again. So I am wondering, since she already cracked her tibia of one of her feet, legs 10 years before, I'm wondering if it's the same leg.
I mean, it's like the difference between a solid thing and a perforated thing, right?
Not.
It tears easier, like if it's perforated.
Yeah, but a perforation is still abnormal. You could have like a crack or a break that fully heal.
Right. But, well, for instance, exactly. But here's what I'm going to say. I have, personally, a foot with a break that they never set. And it is always going to be an ugly bone. Now, I'm not saying it's not going to be stronger in that state, but it would seem to me that if there was going to be a bone that had weakness in it, it would be the one that they never set. So it's not a clean, straight bone. Well,
if it's not properly aligned, then it doesn't have the correct, yes, but it doesn't have the most beneficial alignment given to us by science and physics, or sorry, by nature, evolution, and which equals physics. So that, yes, your malaligned, misaligned thing, that it can't take probably as much pressure as a properly healed one could.
And they don't have the benefits of x-rays and ultrasounds, yeah, and MRIs and all the things to see whether or not the bone is completely in alignment or not. They just kind of get it as close as they can and then say, don't move.
Go for it.
Be still.
Good luck. So she yells for Jamie, I'm here. She takes Jamie's dirk and plunges it into a man's chest. And then she goes, sorry.
Sorry. But then she also hits him right in the rib and loses her knife, doesn't she?
I think so, yes. So she slices the rope connecting the two ships, and they begin to separate. The man she'd stabbed comes for her again, and she sees mad. Jamie. Jamie asks for his dirk. She finds it, gives it to him, and he takes it and goes back into the ship. She holds up her knife and tells people to stand back. Another man comes for her and she slashes him across the forehead. Then she takes a pin out of the boat. Don't ask me. Then it's named in the chapter. A pin out of the boat and hits the head of the man whose forehead she'd slashed. The helmsman finally comes for her, his hand around her throat, and they kind of fall down and she passes out. So when she eventually wakens to Jamie's voice, lots of things had happened. They're still on the pit. They've got most of the pit crew in the hold. She goes to the deck and sees Ian holding a pistol toward a sailor he was chatting with. And she's introduced to a man named Guinea Dick. I love these names. Trustworthy Guinea Dick.
Does this feel even a little bit like she was done writing action and said, I'm just going to have her pass out so I can stop writing what happens in this scene, and then we'll just talk about it in past tense?
Well, yeah, but when you talk, well, depending on how it's talked about in passing, it can still be writing action. But yes.
But I mean, it was like big fight, big fight, big fight. I'm going to lose consciousness too. Fight's over. We're all safe now. But let me tell you what happened.
Well, I think, remember, this is also through a Claire POV. So it's limited, right? You can only see what she sees. So it might be a lot harder to write a lot of action through Claire's POV than it is in third person, because you can go everywhere with that. So that's potentially something. She's like, let me, she needs to pass out so I can actually go on and talk about things. A lot had happened while she'd been unconscious. No one knows where the boat is headed, meaning the pit. They were headed north, though.
This is like very Willy Wonka. There's no way of knowing which way the boat is going.
The next big regular port would be New York. And Claire makes it clear to us, quote, we had gone in the space of an hour from passengers on the way to Scotland to fugitives on the way to God knows where, unquote. And she'd left. I can't say she'd left. I mean, she did. Did she leave them? Yes. But maybe because it was her own volition, she threw herself onto the pit. Then, yes, I guess you could say she left. But I don't think that's necessarily the best verb to use. But her acupuncture needles were left on the teal. I wouldn't say she left them, because like she didn't purposely say, oh, I'm going to jump on this ship and purposely forget my acupuncture needle. Absolutely not.
Well, then she should have really thought ahead and left him in Jamie's head so she'd never lose him.
She didn't. Oh, Summer, that's gross. In their chat about where to go to port, they discover that Mr. Smith is not a loyalist. They decide to sail for New Haven, Connecticut. Jamie quickly, or all of a sudden, lunges at Guinea Dick just in time to save Ian from being stabbed. In a tumble of movement, Claire grabs the pistol from Mr. Smith's hand. And then Claire remembers Rollo.
You can't forget Rollo.
Back on the Teal. And not only on the other ship, but locked in a room. Locked
that
in
is
a room.
Like, that is like the Lewis Capaldi.
That's sad.
Video all over again.
Claire was tasked with feeding their prisoners. So she goes and makes some slop, basically. Does her best. Mr. Smith chats with her and compliments her knife skills. And they chat about the possibilities of what to do with the ship and the people. Like, what, you know, when we come aground, what do we do? Blah, blah, blah. So she's prepped the food. And now it's time for people to eat. And she has a bit, too. Now, if I remember correctly, what they decided to do, even though I didn't write it down, in the conversation about what to do with the ship, because now they've decided they're going to go to New Haven. In that conversation, wasn't it said that they would come aground somewhere and let everyone go and they would burn the ship, right? I think that's right. I remember. Yeah. And this is, again, this is the pit, not the Teal. The Teal's the one that had the cargo headed for New Haven, Connecticut for the sister.
The Teal is the only one that has the cargo we care about.
Oh, well, Rollo?
That is Rollo. Yes.
But the stuff in the hold there was meant for New Haven, Connecticut to go to Benedict Arnold's sister. So we shall see.
And that was chapter 30. Join us next time and we will continue our An Echo in the Bone read along.
Finishing off this part, part 3, Privateer, with chapter 31, titled
A Guided Tour to the Chambers of the Heart. And then we'll finish up by starting part 4, Conjunction, with 32, A Flurry of Suspicion.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Alistair H. To find out more how you can support us on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you're interested in continuing the conversation, like you're just not getting enough Outlander, please join us at www.outlanderpod.com/group. And if you're just dying to have some Outlander Pod branded merch, please head to our shop at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
And if you haven't subscribed to our newsletter, the Outlander Pod Gazette, please do. Find us at outlanderpod.com/newsletter. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20. Outlander20 for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.